It is Saturday, October 14th, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, our Week in Geek News segment, followed by a discussion with you and your technical dilemmas.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxel. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP.
This week on the Sunday Morning Classical Fog Lift, KUSP presents the Santa Cruz County Symphony's first concert of the new season. John Larry Granger conducts the orchestra's performance of Gershwin's Piano Concerto, Ravel's Bolero, and La Mer by Debussy. Join host Roger Emanuels this Sunday, the 15th at 11 a.m. Broadcast of the Santa Cruz Symphony season on KUSP is supported by a grant from Red Tree Properties in Santa Cruz.
Today on Geek Speak, we are doing geek news. We like to call it the Weekend Geek. What's going on this week? And it's a little light this week, but during the second half of the show, we'll welcome you to join the conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can contact us right now. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. Geek Speak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxel. In the air, I'm with me, Drew Miles. Miles Elam. Drew Meyer, Sean Cleveland. Drew Meyer is the product manager at Network Appliance, and just read that beautiful promo. You know, Drew, you've got a great voice. Just every week, I'm amazed by your voice.
Well, thank you.
Sean Cleveland is the technical marketing manager at NVIDIA, and Miles Elam is the technical trainer at Surf Control. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Turn Miles on.
Yeah. I mean, I like doing
just
that.
Just waking up
Miles,
in the morning. And Sean, too.
Oh, man.
Wow, Miles.
Get with these
Lyle,
buttons.
Come
on.
Do something? I didn't know these buttons did something.
That's it. You're getting a pay cut.
Wow. I have to pay to be here?
That's okay. I'll chip in part of my salary for him.
Much less than nothing.
We did the pledge drives closed. Last week we did our pledge drive. Miles, thanks so much for doing that. I want to thank all of you for contributing and for listening to Geek Speak. On KUSP. We really, really appreciate it, and it's wonderful. We beat our numbers exactly what we needed to get, basically, and I really appreciate everybody. Especially, we have like 150 new subscribers to KUSP, which is really exciting.
Excellent.
Superb.
Yeah. All right, Miles, let's start with you on the news.
I heard it was 143.
Thank you very much.
I don't remember. Is that important? Because it was more or less than he said.
I said 150.
You know, we're all about accuracy here at Geek Speak.
That's true. Because
we're rounding to the nearest 50. Whatever, man.
We should have done it in binary. Miles, let's start with you.
There's an organization known as Spam House. For those of you who have ever administered a mail server, you would have heard that name before.
Because you love them.
They're known as a RBL, real-time black hole list, or a DNSBL, DNS blacklist. Much the
what
same.
What does a real-time blacklist
What did you
do?
Just say? I'm sorry. Come on.
They are an RBL service. And
RBL.
What that means...
Real-time black hole listing.
Ribald. Yes.
What that means is when someone connects to you, a mail server, someone tries to connect to send you email, you can go look up this list and see, are they in a list of known spammers, known virus authors, known phishers... And
see, these guys are the good guys,
right?
Spam House,
the spam
is the good
world.
Guys.
That's
right. Now, the thing is, though, that Spam House doesn't actually block the material. All they're doing is making a list, and someone who's setting up a mail server would then say, "Okay, I trust these folks. I'm going to look at that list, see if the IP address of the computer trying to connect to me is in their list. If it is, I can, you know, do whatever, take some appropriate action."
Wait, does that handshake happen with every transaction, or? Do you go look at that once a day and update the list? Or
no,
do you copy the list down
just about
to your
every
mail
transaction,
server?
But there's some caching involved, but it's basically every transaction.
Wow, that's a lot of traffic.
It's like DNS. Yeah,
do we use that on CorkDog?
Yes, we do.
Which is our GeekSpeak server.
Yes.
So, and does it help in blocking spam?
It blocks approximately 1,000 potential messages per day.
For 7 people.
For 7 people.
And for free. Pay for that, right?
Right. If you have a large organization, you're doing a whole bunch of traffic to them, they ask that you pay a subscription fee to them. But
okay, so it's an open source. And how do people get added and subtracted from that list?
Well, you just do bad things. You send spam, or you have a server that you have configured to be what's known as an open relay, that you'll accept email from connection from anywhere, email from anywhere to, and deliver it to anywhere else. And normally what will happen with their RBL is they'll contact the person who's administering the server saying, hey, your server
is doing something wrong.
It's a misconfiguration.
So this sounds perfect and wonderful, and why are you bringing it up? I mean, it's just a great feature of the internet and community.
Because a spammer sued them in Illinois court.
Saying they're interfering with his business.
Right. They have us listed. We're not a spammer. This isn't right. When going to their website, they're an e-marketer.
As much as spam is annoying and everything, there's nothing actually illegal about these people sending out messages. They might participate in illegal activity, but there's sending unsolicited emails, is there any laws against that?
There actually are. So, I mean, that's where the U.S. Can Spam Act comes into play.
Sure.
Because many spammers will
fake things.
Well, what happens with a lot of organizations is all those zombie PCs that we talk about on a regular basis, those are used for spamming. In other words, you have an appropriation of someone else's property to do your bidding, to do the service for you.
So this lawsuit comes out from a spammer or an e-marketing person that's sending a lot of messages. They feel that this spam house organization, which is probably a nonprofit, is interfering with their business model. So they decided to take them to court, sue them in U.S. court. And what happens?
Well, Spam House made a mistake, and they said, well, we're not Illinois. You should take this to federal court. So by doing so, they were implicitly accepting federal jurisdiction in the U.S. Thing is, that they're a U.K. organization.
So then they said, we're a U.K. organization. Leave us alone.
Right after the fact. Uh-huh. But from a legal standpoint, they'd already accepted jurisdiction within the U.S.
and
this federal court.
And this is the case that the judge basically defaultly
made a default judgment and in favor of the plaintiff. Now, what this means, though, is that judgment included a $11.7 million fine, which, to put this into context, Spam House is a 3-4-person organization. It's that economy of scale with, you set up computers, as long as you know how to do it, you can have it done. And they were also pushing to have ICANN remove their internet domain, spamhouse.org.
So the judge defaultly goes with the spammer and slaps a... Do you say $11 million?
For perfectly legitimate legal reasons.
Yeah. Did you say $11
million? $11.7
million. $11.7 million, which would totally destroy this group called Spam House.
Completely.
It doesn't make sense. But they're saying, hey, we're in the UK. You can't really touch us, so forget it. And now they're saying, actually, there's a whole bunch of ways that they can get they can actually get served this judgment. This judgment can actually function.
Well, there are also other issues, too. I mean, if they continue to do business or continue to have this list up in violation of that court order, that's contempt of court. That means that the people who are involved with Spam House, if they ever came to the U.S., they'd be immediately subject to arrest.
I would think there'd be some lawyers that would be interested in helping them with this process.
Well, I know what. Let's take their list. Since they're going to be slapped with an $11 million fine, we'll take the list and we'll put it on our server and we'll charge everyone a quarter of a penny to use it.
Yeah, but at the same time...
That's definitely possible. Some other group could do the exact same thing.
It's the service that's important. It's not the company or the company.
That's true.
Name.
Right. But they are going through the appeals process. They're going to try to... The thing is, the default judgment's hard to fight. But they are going to go through the appeals process, try to get it overturned. And in the meantime, there's also hope that individuals in the U.S. government or other folks will get involved. For example, with the BlackBerry case.
Right.
That was one where you had U.S. Congress getting involved saying, no, we want our BlackBerries. We're not going to allow
this.
And
people hate spam, so hopefully people will try to support
this. If Spam House went away, I mean, they are the single largest real-time black hole list on the net in the
world.
Right,
and if 7 people are getting 1,000 messages a day blocked with help from this list, this means it would be a major amount of increase of spam.
Right, and this is not just businesses. This is also entities within the U.S. government.
All right, well, thank you, Miles, very much for the case. Let's keep on top of that. Let's go to the next news story. Drew, please.
Sure. There's a local firm, local, I guess, in San Jose. They're called Fat Spaniel Technologies, and they've come up with this little gadget that you attach to your roof, and it measures the amount of sun that's falling on your roof. And they've designed this thing that now integrates into a network and measures the amount of sun that's falling on a roof and makes that visible to people who are thinking about investing in solar power. Now, they're the first company that's ever done anything like this, and they've just closed a $7 million round of funding. And I think it's exciting that a small local company that's doing something that's never been done before is experiencing this kind of success. They've got installations. Go ahead.
Are these multiple little sensors that just kind of pop on your roof for
a
while?
It's one sensor that ties into the array if you have a solar panel. And measures how much energy you're producing, how much is you're consuming, and gives you a real-time output and tracks all that data and puts it on the web so you can go see it from any place at any time.
Cool. So
you
can
see wireless?
It's not wireless at the moment. It attaches to your inverter, which is the gadget which converts the DC current from the panels into AC for your house.
But the cool thing is now you're collecting a knowledge base of how much energy you can collect from the sun depending on areas. So if you're on the coast in the fog, you start knowing.
Yeah, and it shows you precisely everything that happens every day, every second. When you get your bill from the power company, they give you a monthly summary. It doesn't take into account the clouds, the sun, situations where somebody leaves a light on, and it gives you much better visibility into what's going on. So from a developer's perspective, you're talking about a service that can monitor the amount of electricity they're generating or not generating and help make the case for putting solar energy in place on commercial buildings.
That sounds like a big piece of the puzzle. Because with the PG&E thing, of course, all they're doing is looking at how much energy total your house is used. You could use a lot less energy and not be producing anything with your solar panels and still, you know, I mean, still affect your bill.
To that point, studies in Japan where solar power is big because of high density and expensive energy show that consumers can reduce the energy demand by 11 to 13% when people who are in a solar-enabled building become conscious of energy consumption. Normally, it's the guy who pays the bills who runs around turning off the lights. But when everybody gets aware of it and can see what's happening, then the consumption goes down by almost 10%.
Makes a lot of sense.
And one more point, they've successfully done installations on Walmart in two locations as Walmart's getting interested in using their giant rooftops as solar collection facilities. And they're doing some trials in Canada, Missouri, and Florida for some hot water heaters. Up until the 1920s in L.A., all hot water came from solar heaters because there's more thermal energy in sunlight than there is electrical.
Right.
And these guys are going to start picking up on that, too.
Wow. If businesses like Walmart are looking into this, there must be some payback.
Yeah.
Think about the amount of square footage they have and the amount of lights they run and the amount of time that they're on.
Yeah, they must have done all the work and realized it's going to save money. They wouldn't do it.
It's pennies falling on the roof all day long.
Yeah. All right, thank you very much, Drew, for that
story.
You
know, pennies falling on the roof would actually hurt the solar array.
Yeah, you're right, Sean.
Oh, I get it.
What
it's
am
a
I
metaphor.
Morning, Sean.
Engineers and marketers in the same room.
That's right. I guess we're the marketers. So, Transmeta is suing Intel for patent infringement.
You used to work for Transmeta.
Oh, wow.
I did.
Do they have a case?
I sure hope so.
Because you have stock in the company.
You know, I like Intel just fine. But, you know, after being at Transmeta and having to battle Intel marketing fund.
Need some more dough, huh?
It was so frustrating.
So what's
the case? Transmeta came in and came up with a great idea, low-powered chips, you know, for thin and light notebooks.
Extremely low power, right?
Extremely low power, yeah. We're talking like a gigahertz for a few watts of power.
And a processor then looks at what's going on and decides to step its power use down because it's not being used as much. That's kind of how it works, right? I mean, that's a weak
description. They also had, yes, this power-saving technology built into the chips that allowed them to get down to that lower. But the thing was, Sony and Fujitsu came out with notebooks that were thinner and lighter that no one else could get into. Intel couldn't put their chips in it, way too thin. The heat that their chips put off.
I remember when you had
wouldn't work in that thermal envelope.
When you had your Transmeta laptops, it was like they were almost
it was
toys.
Incredible. Yeah,
so light.
But the problem with
no
Transmeta's
fan.
Chips is they just weren't powerful enough. So they were low power, but they didn't give enough performance. And by the time they got the performance up, Intel was low power enough. And then Transmeta had created all these new markets, and Intel came in and said, "Oh."
You know, we fit that market now.
We fit that now, yeah, we'll take it. So now Transmeta is saying, wait a minute, all that technology that you came up with is based on our patents, 10 of them to be precise.
Wow.
And we think that the $100 billion worth of chips that you've sold that use these technologies, we should get a cut of. So that's what's going on. Intel has not commented.
Has it affected Transmeta's standing in the stock market?
Yeah. Well,
Transmeta's taken a beating lately.
Transmeta was almost delisted at one point.
No, I mean, has the suit helped them?
Yeah. Their stock's gone up about 30 cents, 24 to 30 cents.
So can you buy a new house now?
Without, yeah. Without this,
I don't think that's ever going to happen with their stock.
Without this case, Sean, are they viable as a company still?
Well, yeah. Transmeta no longer makes chips. They now have other companies make their chips for them. They're more of a technology house now. Mm. They come up with intellectual properties, and they then sell royalty based agreements with fabs, right. Mostly fabs. Fujitsu and EC, Sony, they're all using Transmeta's chip technology for lower power in all of their chips.
So and at some and point, all, that'll start paying Transmeta, unlike Intel.
Yeah, right? Supposedly someday that's going to pay off for Transmeta.
Yeah.
But, you know, don't hold your breath.
Well, thank you very much for that story. Sean, Mr. Elam, hi.
Sean, Mr. Elam?
I said...
Oh, thank you, Sean. Okay, got it.
Worked. It
sorry,
a
I was
there.
A little confused. I'm sorry, I didn't know who you were talking to.
I think there's actually a full stop, actually. So, Miles, what's up?
The One Laptop Per Child program, formerly known as the $100 laptop.
Mm-hmm. Like with a hand crank on the side?
Sometimes the hand crank's going to be used, sometimes it isn't. They're right. Worried too much about durability issues. But getting into it, one thing that they're worried about now is security. Right now, one of the big things about Windows is the fact that it's this huge monoculture. One Windows machine is much like the same. That's how viruses are able to spread so easily. And when you have that many machines out there, having a virus spread so much is, it's like in biology. The higher the population density, the easier it is for pathogens to...
A side effect of this we see is that there's not a lot of viruses for the Linux environment, the Unix environment, or Macintosh environment because the density... One of the theories is that the density is not high enough. There's not enough people with those operating systems.
Well, it's definitely a contributing factor. It's not necessarily the reason for it, but it's a contributing factor.
When the one laptop per child thing hits, we're going to see all of a sudden a giant new operating system
emerge. Right, for what they have planned for the one laptop per child, they're talking about doing huge volumes, and we already have something like... they already have 6 or 7 countries on board are getting millions of units.
So it's gonna get close to the Microsoft numbers, do you think?
If they actually ship what they're already planning on right now, I mean, it will become the most predominant desktop in the world.
Okay, and it's got this whole node thing where if one computer near you has internet access, then everyone can share it.
Right, a mesh network.
You already have a mesh network situation going on with these laptops. So the concern would be if there's a vulnerability in the operating system, then it's going to spread fast.
Right.
The virus would spread fast.
Right, and so they're looking at different things to harden it.
Yeah.
For example, virus protection within the kernel itself. And within the master boot.
Are they using what operating system are they using? Are they using Linux?
It's Linux, yes. Uh-huh. And a lot of custom hardware and a lot of things that are really interesting. It's a very, very great project.
Yeah.
At least from a technical point of view, just R&D.
So how are they going to do? How are they going to make sure it's bulletproof? I'm assuming they have to make a whole bunch of units and put it in a field test, right?
Well, anything made by humanity can be cracked by humanity eventually. But the best you can do is just the best you can do. Try to go in there, try to hack into it. You have a lot of what they've been doing is calling in for a lot of security experts and a lot of... frankly, hackers to come in and try to break the system now rather than later.
There's been some talk that in some earlier trials we'll actually be able to get one of these. You could buy one, not being a disadvantaged child that needs a laptop, but you could actually go ahead and spend some dough and get one. How much do they run in this perspective of
what,
buying one?
What I've seen so far, they're talking about having these laptops available for the general public, like here in the U.S., for $300.
So pricier than what they'll actually be selling to governments.
Right, and the idea being that we would be subsidizing the ability for a child to have this laptop to learn
off of. Sounds like a good deal to me. I think the geeks should chip in and buy one so we can play with it. So when it comes available, let us know.
Yeah, there was a listing. I'll look it up and I'll try to post it to the website as well.
And I'd like to talk about a little bit about it because the laptop's designed to be really low power, plug in anything. They're not exactly doing the crank all the time because the crank could potentially damage it.
But the power output is, I mean, the ability to have access to reliable power isn't there. So it needs to be very low power so the battery can last a long time, but also very resistant to wide power, wide voltage.
These laptops are going to be starting to be used for people that need to write, you know, regularly need to write and not need to do complicated things. I'm excited about them. Well, thank you very much for that story about the laptops. Miles? Drew, hi.
Good morning. So there's an interesting proposal in the Debrecen Airport in Hungary. It's been in development for 2.5 years by the University College of London. It's called OpTag. It's radio radio tags on a necklace that you put around your neck when you walk in the airport. And then those radio tags all communicate with a giant central system that knows where you are, so that you can, so that you don't miss your flight, or so that they know where you are when it comes time to get you on the plane. So there's, it's a pretty interesting idea, because I have had, I've missed flights, even when I'm standing in the security line and they call my name, I don't hear it, or they don't call the name, they just let the flight go, even though I could have caught it had I known. And that would be a convenient service for me. But on the flip side, I'm not sure if I want them to know exactly where I'm going and what I'm doing. And one of the issues they've come up against trying to figure this out is, what prevents me from taking my tag off and handing it to someone else?
Yeah.
Or setting it down in the bathroom and leaving it?
They need to inject it into your bloodstream. Because that... I mean, it's kind of scary. Is it really going to be that useful in that they'll hold flights for people? I mean, I would assume that if they're ready to take off and you're in the security line, even if they know you're in the security line, they're going to take the they're going to make the plane go anyway.
In my experience, it would have been it certainly would have been possible, and it would have been convenient to pull me to the front of the line, or just, you know, organize the line a little better. That kind of stuff drives me nuts anyway. I don't know why they don't segment the line so that people who are later can get up to the front faster.
Well, of course, the argument is that get there earlier. That's what they're always saying. Arrive at the airport 3 hours before your flight.
Sure, but when somebody has a tantrum at the gate, then it delays the plane anyway.
Sure, definitely.
I don't know. It's just an interesting idea. RFID tag technology has gotten to the point where you can have a long range, like 10 to 20 meters, where it used to be a matter of feet.
And then they could have these at most of the intersections, and they'd start understanding the traffic flow. I'm just curious.
Traffic flow, and on groceries, you wouldn't have to pay at the checkout counter anymore. Sure. You just walk out and checks your bill automatically. There's all kinds of
opportunities. The magic future of technology. RFID is very cool. I saw this wonderful art project about using them, and it was actually taking rodents, or cockroaches, excuse me, and putting RFID tags on a cockroach that would then walk around warehouses and mess up everything. But that was more of a deviant... art project. I like the project. I think it was cool, but I don't think Walmart likes it. Thank you very much for keeping us up to date on RFID. I think it's a very important technology. Sean, one more before we go to taking calls.
Yeah. Well, we all know that punk rockers love, you know, geeking out, right?
No? Of course. I don't know.
I don't know. Tattoo. Okay. Well, I gotta talk about CBGBs.
No. What's going on with CBGB?
They're closing their doors.
No way.
So they lost their landlord dispute.
I'm sorry. CBGBs. I don't know them.
Yeah. What is
that? Whoa. It's the epicenter, the heart of American rock movement from punk
music especially. It's where it all began.
It's
30 years ago.
Storefront? Downtown Greenwich Village.
Talking Heads, Blondie, Devo. You know,
we
love Devo. Our theme song. All these bands played there
Sex
in the early days.
First
the Ramones.
In the States.
They played there for the first time. So
I feel so unhip.
Miles, you are.
So a lot of people ask,
gonna kill me.
What does CBGB stand for? It stands for Country Bluegrass Blues, but it ended up being a punk band club. And then underneath CBGB, if you look at the sign, it says OMFUG.
Umfug.
It means other music for uplifting gormandizers. And a gormandizer is a voracious eater of, in this case, music.
I see. But they're really closing their doors?
Yeah. It looks like they're going to try. He's going to move it. I'm trying to remember the owner's name here. Hilly Crystal. He lost his lease. They've been fighting it for a long time. He's going to move it to Las Vegas, I guess. And, you know, I could see this place in Las Vegas working out. And he's gonna,
in a different
I guess he's
sort
gonna,
of way.
In a very different sort of way.
The purity of punk is kind of lost in Las Vegas, right?
Depends on where they put it in Las Vegas. I've been in some pretty seedy areas there. Yeah. But he's going to rip everything out of CBGBs and move it, even the urinals.
Good. How about the graffiti-covered walls?
Yes.
All right.
That's what he said.
I figure since you're talking about punk, we might as well put Devo on. Geek Speak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to Geek Speak.
We're taking your calls right now with questions and comments of technology. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Use internet. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. GeekSpeak is supported by Cruise.io Internet, offering DSL broadband, computer rentals, and tune-ups. Cruise.io has retail stores in downtown Santa Cruz and Watsonville. More information can be found online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning, Miles Elam, Drew Meyer, and Sean Cleveland. You can call us up right now and ask us questions and comments of technology. We'll answer anything you want about your technical desires and needs and problems, of course, and dilemmas. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'm going to do those again, nice and slow. In the 831 area code, 476-2800. Or call us for free in California, 1-800-655. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. We'll answer anything you'd like today.
One of the first questions we need to answer is this person who just wrote us an email. What's the name on that, Sean?
D. D Driver. How much is the solar measuring device that you just described, and where can I get it?
So go read about it at fatspaniel.com. They have this cute dog, and the company's named after the dog. So Fat Spaniel, just like it sounds. It's available as a service where you pay it sort of a monthly fee, and they provide the monitoring hosting service for you. So I don't have an exact price for it. The best way to do that if you're in the local area is to talk to Mike Aronson. I think he's a reseller for these companies.
Solar Mike.
SolarMike.net. He's a sometime listener of the show and sometimes a guest, and very, very up to date on all the latest developments in solar energy in the area.
This makes sense, I think, having this as a service, because then they can start generalizing the data that's collected and use it as a service also to help to show people how useful solar is. And I assume the technology is a little expensive. So it sounds like you enter in a contract with them, they start providing the technology to do this, and you get this great feedback on your system.
I don't have an idea of the pricing, but this is not a $50 commitment. This is more like a $250 commitment, I think, from what I looked at it before. I don't happen to have one on my system at home right now, although I'm very tempted. And the reason is you have to have in addition to this system, you have to have it able to connect into your system, and you have to add some modifications to your inverter
that
I mentioned.
And all it's going to do is give you access to it over the internet, right? I mean, you can go look at your...
If I walked out every morning and stood there and watched the inverter all day long, I would get the same data, but I can't do that.
You could.
Can't you get a daily report?
My inverter doesn't connect to my network right now, which is one of the issues.
Well, this probably is going to be very... desirable for people that are installing new systems.
A great compliment, and the larger a system you get, the more money you're talking about, the more sense this thing makes.
SolarMike.org, SolarMike.com.
SolarMike.net.
SolarMike.net.
Yeah, but I heard the state's important. Not letting you get into the net anymore. What do they call it?
That's right. PG&E has... They renewed it, right?
They renewed it.
Okay. They renewed it.
The governor, in fact, recently, I think we covered this on an earlier show.
I think we did.
Renewed the solar bills and has done some more aggressive promotion of alternative energy in the state, and solar is one of them.
You know, the most important thing at this point is I can't reach that cake. Could you pass me some of that
cake? Oh, please, yeah. What kind of cake is this?
I don't know, actually. I haven't had it yet. But it is made by this wonderful person that makes cakes. Gosh, Edith... what is it again?
Edith Meyer wedding cake that Lyle is sampling
.com.
Right now.
You got to say the .com. Sorry, you don't say the .com.
I'm embarrassed to be so blatantly promoting. EdithMeyer.com, that's right.
Does she thank you every time you do that? I'm just out of curiosity.
I can't talk about that on the air, Lyle. In
fact, all right, let's take your calls with questions and comments of technology.
You may have seen her recently. She was featured in the Santa Cruz Sentinel.
Oh, cool. All right. From Big Sir, John, welcome to Geek Speak. Oh, wait a second. There you go. I couldn't push the button with cake in my hand. All right, John, what's up?
Yeah, hi. I wanted to get some information. I was reading off my computer on a science news hit that Intel is finally stopped the war on or reached the holy grail on the chip speed, and that they're going to use the laser light to design the new CPUs, and they'll be running at the speed of light. And I'm wondering how that's going to affect things in computing, like front end.
Well, there's been a desire forever to put laser on the chip. And people always, I mean, there's new breakthroughs, everything, but nobody's going into production yet.
Not that I've heard of.
But, John, do you want to address how that works?
Yeah,
you
know?
Yeah.
They've built next generation fabs.
They said 18 months before it went into production at Intel's news release. So that's why I was kind of interested.
I didn't read that. Well, you know what, though? I've just been in contact with Intel.
Cool.
I was talking to their PR rep, Dan Schneider, and he's interested in coming on the show and talking about their stuff. So I think in November we're going to have them on.
Okay. Do you see it affecting computing in the near future, like the next 24 months or so?
Well, yeah. the,
I don't know if it's really going to make much of a difference. It's just a new process technology.
Yeah.
In fact, you got to understand when they shrink the copper on the transistors, there's so much work going on at the fabs to get the speeds up.
Yep.
But by the time they actually shrink it down to the next level, you don't see anything because they've optimized the previous size so well.
Yeah, I read this great. I mean, the issue with using light for your switches, basically, because the processors is a whole bunch of switches. There's millions of them. How many transistors are on the most recent chips now?
Oh, there's
man, billions.
Yeah, it's billions. It's like 200. I think it's like
core processor.
I think it's like 200 billion.
Yeah,
yeah. It's just insane amount of numbers. Each one of those is a little switch that actually has three leads on it, basically. But with light, if you want to switch that entire thing to light, now you've got to have all these photon detectors and photon senders, and you've got to be able to switch them on and off cheaply. And to do that all with light is difficult. So you'd it's going to
be
a migrate
for heat.
But then it's going to be wonderful.
I mean, that would be the
but
heat.
It's extremely complicated to do that. And it's getting closer.
And I don't know if anyone's actually made a chip yet that does a conversion from copper to optics.
They made transistors now that they're able to do it, but it's like, okay, now we just have to make 100 billion of those. So we're going to see. It's going to be a while, but the promises are great. They're low energy, low heat, basically, because you have a lot less wasted heat in the switching. And I wouldn't say necessarily faster, because you're still going to deal with electronics running the show.
That's what I was interested in, because if they come out with a processor's chip that's running at this speed, how's that affect the rest of our
It's not going to run.
It's an
age-old
question. It's a matter of valves, and as soon as you open one valve up higher, the next slowest valve becomes the bottleneck.
Yeah, and it's not a.
Actually, the buses that connect the chips together are so far ahead of what the chips can produce.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah, right now.
Thank you very much for the call.
You bet. Thank you.
Bye bye. Well, it is. One of the things about talking about new edge tech like this is that if you have one of the scientists that's actually working on it, they know what the figures are and they know exactly what's going on. We're just kind of saying a general thing at this point, which I know I'm going
to
get.
I think it'd be good to get an architect on and talk about this kind of stuff.
I think it's a great topic, definitely.
And definitely get a fab person in here. Let's see what we can do.
All right. From Santa Cruz, Chris, welcome to Geek Speak.
Whoa.
Hi.
Yo.
You're on.
You're up.
What's
that's
up?
Great. A couple of weeks ago, I called in because I was having a problem erasing some files, and Lyle gave me an answer off the air, which was it may be just as simple as defragging, which I've now done, and I can erase those files. It got me interested in defragging more often, and I've purchased
good.
A program called Diskkeeper 10, which was recommended on the Langa list, another geek newsletter.
Did you say that my suggestion actually worked?
It's not gonna
we need a fanfare.
Whoa, it worked. I need like some kind of sound effect.
Yeah, you know why? Did you use the Windows?
Wild. Thank you very much.
Did you do the Windows defrag?
I did the Windows defrag, and whenever I do that, it looks like everything is wonderful. However, now that I'm using this.
So the Windows defrag does a check disk first.
Yeah.
And the check disk is what fixed the problem.
Yeah.
So
this other product that you got, are you happier with it? You like it?
Well, I noticed that when I'm using it, it says that a substantial number of files are fragmented.
Yeah.
I mean, really, big time. Mm-hmm. And I have noticed that I have a real difficulty installing new games or new programs.
How full is this disk, Chris?
Well, let's see. I think I've got about 19% free space.
You're getting,
that's the edge.
You're
that's
getting borderline there, yeah.
So
you want to have it above
10%. Can you take it and defrag it, or does it stop?
Well, it senses when it needs to defrag and will start doing that operation.
Okay.
It just keeps chugging away. I've done it many, many times.
Oh, it just keeps it to check to see if it needs to do it? Just let it go all night long?
Yes, I've done that.
Uh-huh. And it still says multiple fragmentation?
Yes, it's pretty substantial. When I go and I try and look at different files, when I highlight them and look at properties, I have a little check in the read-only box. and there's nothing that I can do to make them.
Okay, this is what I would suggest you do at this point. Because you're going to spend a lot of time working on this problem, but what's happening is you need a new hard drive. I mean, that's what I'd recommend. Get a new hard drive.
Well,
because he's having trouble defragmenting and he's having trouble
That's not a problem with the hard drive.
Maybe the hard drive is too full.
Ooh, if the drive is...
He's got 19%.
He's not that close.
19% available.
Yeah.
90% available? That's getting close to
it. You understand that you need... The less space you have, the longer it's going to take to defrag because... The defrag occurs in that free space.
You're shuttling all these pieces around.
Yeah, you're moving stuff back and forth. If you had more free space, the defrag would happen quicker.
The reason I'm suggesting a hard drive is it's not that much expense, and he's been working on this problem for 2 weeks.
But that's so if you've got large contiguous files, which means one file is very large by itself, and then you've got a small free space, that file can't be defragged.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, if you've got a bunch of those.
Well, it can. It's just going to take forever because it's going to take segments of it.
There's just not enough free space to move that file to so it can all be together.
Yeah, but no, it'll move the file to multiple places. It'll split the file up. That's what fragmentation is. So it's just going to take forever to move things around.
And then your disk access is going to suck.
Oh, yeah. The disk access on this machine probably is bad anyway. But the thing is, he can't actually get through a defrag. That's a problem, especially since he has 19% availability. So something's wrong. And settings on files are being changed to read-only, and he wasn't able to erase
those
files.
No, those are system files that are read-only.
Oh, you think they're system
files? Some of them are just document files that I use.
Now, this is the exact same thing. Remember, he had these files in the shared location, and he couldn't erase them. Something's wrong with his what is it called, the directory?
NTFS?
Well, whatever.
Was this hard drive used in another system? Windows install?
Before this problem emerged, I did have to reinstall... And I had to recover my files.
Yeah.
From
what you might be seeing is that the files that might have been in your My Documents directory, when you reinstalled Windows, did you have a password for your login?
Or did you change your name at all?
No.
Because if you had a password before, that could lock you out of your files. It could change the read-only properties. There could be things like that happening.
Is there a tool in Windows that you can fix the permissions?
It's called Linux.
Yeah, you can strip all that. There is a method for doing it. I don't remember off the top of my head. I've had to do it before.
Chris, thanks for the update on your dilemmas. It sounds like you're still kind of stuck. That's the reason I suggest a new hard drive. You buy a new hard drive, you install your operating system on that, and you slowly migrate your data over, your machine's going to run a lot faster.
One thing you could do, Chris, is how much of this is your personal data and how much of it is applications and system stuff?
It looks like a lot of it is my personal data.
So you should probably move that to another place.
Copy it, back it up.
Yes, I've got it backed up on the external hard drive.
Well, use the external. Okay, then here's what you could do. This is a little bit maybe risky, so listen if you want or ignore it if you want.
But don't blame Drew if it goes bad.
Right. It's not my fault. But here's something. I would do this if I had this problem. I would take the live data that's important on my C drive, and I would delete it all after I backed it up to my external drive. Mm-hmm. And then I would defrag the system, with all of the system files and the application files that are on it. That'll give you a whole lot more space in which to do this.
And the defrag will take less time,
And then you can bring back the data files that are important from that backup drive and start running off the C drive again.
The other way to do it is plan to go away for the weekend, make sure you got a UPS, power supply for your computer, start the defrag process, and then come back in 4 days.
Why do you need a UPS?
Just in case power goes out, because it would kind of suck to... have the power go out during the middle of that.
So you get another 15 minutes?
Well, yeah. And then you have it connected to the computer, so it shuts down.
Okay, Gus.
Cranky.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. Good luck.
Well, it sounds like I've got 3 strategies. I'll try them all.
Great. All right. Don't do it at the same time. All right.
By then, your hard drive will be completely worn out.
Yeah. And you'll need a new one. See? It's perfect.
I kind of like O&O defrag.
You gave me that one time on a machine that was really slick.
Yeah.
From Santa Cruz, Steve, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello, Lyle. It's Steve Brenner. How are you?
Hi, Steve. Quite well.
Good, good.
Hey, how's the Mac Mini with the external FireWire drive? Does that run fast still?
Continuously runs just the way it did when I last called. It's really the best thing to do with a Mac Mini. It's the best thing you can do with a Mac Mini because it makes up for the few shortcomings that a Mac Mini has, and that is the slow access to that drive that comes in it because it's really like a laptop hard drive. It's a low-speed hard drive. So having the external FireWire drive as the startup disk, and I just use the internal disk as the backup, and I use my external disk as my startup and my main disk, and it works just fine.
Cool.
Yeah, that's mini stack product.
Mini stack, okay.
They also make a mini skirt, which goes under a mini.
Okay, so now what's your concern or question or thoughts?
Well, my thought has nothing to do with the computer. It has to do with that really neat discussion you had earlier about all the advances in photovoltaic cells and Walmart putting them on their roofs and things like that. I think it's all wonderful, but I have a question, and the question is this. Has anybody ever manufactured a photovoltaic cell that during its lifetime produced more energy than it took to manufacture it?
Well, I think that the issue is, of course, that it takes a ton amount of energy and resources to create the cell in the first place, to make these solar panels. And that's what you're touching on.
Yes,
I don't know the longevity of these cells, but they never really stop working. They just slowly become less and less effective. So
right.
Potentially some that have been around for 15 years have now finally made up their initial
cost.
I
thought it was 10 to 15 years, and they last for 30.
The efficiency, yeah. The earliest ones that we have that are actually in production are from the 70s era. So they're still working. They're just less efficient. They decay over time.
We have brought this up before when we talk about solar energy, that when it comes down to, if you look at the total amount of energy used to create the solar array, you'll never make that back on top of your house, potentially.
So it's a huge issue, and all of these companies like West Marine and perhaps now I hear Walmart, as you say, that are doing this, and of course they're very bottom line, dollars and cents kind of organizations. They have to be in order to stay in business. Would they be doing these photovoltaic installations were it not for the rebates and government intervention financially that tends to make it more profitable for them?
Probably not. But the other thing to note, though, is that using a corporation building these things in maybe a different country, using their energy source, their energy is less expensive than our home energy. So theoretically, the device is still cheaper for you than the amount of power it will give back to you. In fact, that's true, because these things pay back themselves in, 15 years, Drew?
Well, if we lived in a perfect market and the externalities were all accounted for and we actually paid the real price of the energy and the materials and the environmental cost and the labor cost and the human capital impact that it makes, then the whole economy would function differently and maybe solar wouldn't make sense. But we don't live in that world yet, and if Governor Schwarzenegger wants to put tax dollars into promoting silicon without accounting for the energy budgets that go into manufacturing the silicon, then
especially
I'm still a fan of it.
I'm assuming the solar panels are not produced in California. So it's not California's problem where the energy's coming down to make them.
Manufacturers are overseas. Kyocera and Sharp are some of the largest. BP, the British Petroleum, which has now changed their name to Beyond Petroleum, I think. It's kind of a funny marketing geek. They're also one of the manufacturers and doing some of the large efforts, investment in further development.
It's the same kind of dilemma as the hydrogen economy that we hear so much about. You got to produce the energy somewhere, right? So the question is, you're going to solar. Yay, I'm in solar, and these solar panels, blah, blah, blah. And these are produced.
You're saving money.
And you're cutting out a little bit, Steve, unfortunately. You're saving money, but the truth is that it's very possible these solar panels are being produced in a plant that's right next to a really bad polluting coal-burning energy source. So it's possible that your real effect is to produce more toxins in the air.
Yes. Very good.
Thank you.
I wish I had a clear answer.
I really appreciate the call for bringing that topic up, Steve.
All right, Lyle.
Take care.
We'll be in touch.
Bye-bye. I know Steve from...
Now I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight, Lyle.
Hey, don't worry about it. Most likely the solar panels are supported by nuclear energy, which is probably the best energy source we have available, so that's a good thing. Let's go ahead and go. I'm going to get calls for that, aren't I? Promoting nuclears in Santa Cruz is not a good thing to do. From Monterey,
calling it nuclear is bad, too.
Yeah. Sorry.
Easy there, George.
That's the worst thing you can
nuclear.
Do sound like George.
My wife was so frustrated. She heard him on the radio the other night, and she called me up saying, when is he going to learn? How long does it take?
I think it's his signature now. He's got to keep saying it. All right, from Monterey, Anna, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, I'm frustrated, too.
Okay.
Hi, guys. I have a question about Microsoft. I have Office 2003, and I use, at the office, we use Outlook. And I have the three people, one of them's in San Francisco, and my job is to take care of the clients. And I've tried Microsoft's help, and I've tried to get my two geeks to help me, and they don't like Microsoft, so they won't help me. What I've used to manage my files is the Microsoft Outlook client personal folders. I put the emails in there, and then next to the email, I put the date I last got an email or talked to somebody.
Oh, I see.
Because I don't have any way to keep the client list current, and I have like.
Okay, so you are managing your database of people.
Yes.
Using Outlook.
Outlook.
And what's the problem at this point?
My problem is I don't have anywhere to do a little wiki. There's no place. I've tried using tasks to put in, like, say, I called Germany and spoke to the Germany IBM guy, and then I want to share that with the two other people in the office
that are working with you.
And I don't know how to.
I think it would make a lot more sense for you to find some other client relationship management system. Is that what those things are called?
CRM, customer relationship management. But this is a 3-person office, you said, right?
It's small, right? So, and they don't want to, you know,
invest
my boss doesn't want to spend money on that. I just would like, you know, besides sending email and CCing everybody, there's no place where we can, you know, they made something called Track where you could go open up a whiteboard on the internet and to have it all typed in, but then I have to do it twice that way.
There's a Microsoft tool, it's called SharePoint Server, but it sounds like you guys, with three people, are you running Exchange or are these all individual clients connected to your accounts that are out on the internet?
I'm not technical, I'm sorry.
Okay, if you don't recognize the word Exchange, that's all I need to know.
That's totally true. The concern I have, of course, is that if you don't have a backup of your what's called a PST file, your Outlook database, you're really being risky at this point because all your content information, your entire system's in one file, and if that gets corrupt, you are just
toast.
Out of luck.
So
make sure to back up your system, your PST file. Any backup utility should handle that file as well, and it's probably really big at this point.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there any way I can synchronize even the office, like the tasks with the other two fellows through Microsoft?
With Exchange Server, I think you can.
I don't know.
Synchronize the file unless you're not using it.
No, she's talking about the tasks.
But the tasks themselves,
There's a feature in Exchange, and it also works with Outlook, called the Journal, which lets you track everything you do during the day, when you send an email, when you make a call, when you do something. But I don't know if you can share that or have a group version.
Interesting.
You need to get on the chat groups, go to Google Groups.
I think
you should start looking at getting out of Outlook as your CRM. Because it's just not—it's not the right tool.
Well, that's a big project.
That's where my email comes from, and that's why I put it in there. That's how I talk to the customers most of the time.
Right?
Yeah. It's absolutely your critical application. If anybody out there has any ideas on a shareware, groupware program like this, let us know.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
Good luck.
Bye.
Hey, I got my sister calling from Georgia. Hey, Marina, what's up?
Hey, Lyle, can you hear me?
Yeah, no problem. We can all hear you.
Hi guys, good morning over there.
Hi,
so you're finally online, which is
I'm finally online, and of course I have this computer that's a hand me over. So I'm running into some issues, some of which is entirely because I don't know what I'm looking at. But then there's some specific things obviously that I'm going to try to focus on. One of them is, Lyle, you recommended I download the Mozilla Firefox browser.
Mm-hmm.
Which I did, and it's lovely.
Don't listen to your brother. He doesn't know.
Okay. Rule of thumb number one. Okay.
That's first off. Go on.
No, actually, what's going on is the whole point of getting online at this point was to do my online education course with South University, and after downloading the Mozilla Firefox, I found out that it's not a browser that they support. So I've gone back to using Internet Explorer.
Okay.
However, now that I've installed it, it automatically comes up. Mozilla Firefox comes up for certain things, such as
Miles has a solution.
Document stuff, you know, whatever it needs to come up for. And I don't know now if I should uninstall Mozilla Firefox or
no,
something.
No, you should absolutely leave it where it is. And you're going to go to Tools, in the Tools menu.
This is Firefox, right?
No, this is in Internet Explorer. In the Windows.
No, this is in Firefox.
In Firefox, okay.
Yeah, in Firefox, you're going to Tools. And depending upon which version you have, you're going to go to Extensions or Add-ons.
Uh-huh.
And there's going to be a thing at the bottom saying "Get more extensions."
Okay.
When you click on that, what's it going to do?
Miles is like taking you in a direction I don't know if I do, but I like the idea.
Well, no, it'll take you to an extension, and you're going to put into a search to find something called IE tab.
That's the name of the extension.
IE tab.
Yeah,
IE tab.
Tab.
What he's basically going to say is this. This is what he's basically doing. In a Windows environment, you can use any application can actually use Internet Explorer in the background through a technology we don't have to get into. And what he's saying is keep using Firefox. It's a better browser. And when you actually need Internet Explorer,
Right. Well,
you'll use this extension, which will allow Internet Explorer to be inside Firefox.
You can tie a particular URL to the IE tab, so you don't have to think about it anymore. It's just when you go to a particular site, it uses IE as the rendering widget.
That's awesome, Miles.
It's actually, if you go to the extensions page, it's in the list of top extensions.
But what Miles is going to do, because he's so cool and he likes you, is he's going to actually put this information up on the GeekSpeak show page with a little bit of information. And that way, you can follow along with everybody else that wants to do this. It basically allows you to use Internet Explorer only when you need it. And you
this is huge.
Oh,
for all of our listeners, this means you can use Mozilla Firefox all the time. And if you have an application that requires you to use Explorer, this is a solution to get rid of Explorer and lets you run Explorer inside of Firefox.
Right, and you basically just do it by URL. You just take the URL and you put it in. Well, Marina,
just another
thank
tab.
You. Marina, thank you so much. Oh, she's talking to her kids.
No, I'm talking to you.
Okay. You're actually sounding really quiet. I can barely hear you. But Marina, thank you so much. Thank you so much for the call. We got to go.
And, all right. Thank you, guys. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. What a pleasure. She gets online. I sent her an email this morning saying, "Hey, we're going on air," and she actually calls up. That's pretty cool. Let's see if anyone else did. We've got a couple more calls.
We got a note from Mike while we were on the phone.
Solar Mike.
He says that solar cells return the energy it takes to make them in a few years, so now I can't sleep after all.
Oh, good.
And he mentions that he's building a map of the impact of weather in the area, such like fog in the Monterey Bay area, and he's going to come on the show if we have a slot for him and tell us about it.
We definitely have a slot for Solar Mike. We definitely do. In Santa Cruz, Jim, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello.
Hi, Jim. What's your question today?
I enjoy your show.
I
have a ThinkPad laptop, and I have a wireless network at home. I'm running Windows 2000. Works fine at home. When I get on the road and try to connect at the San Jose airport or something, it can see the network, but it just will not connect. I'm using a D-Link Air card.
Okay, the card is inserted into the notebook.
Yeah, it's
are
a
you
little
running,
card.
Are you running Windows XP?
No, it's Windows 2000 Pro.
Oh, man. The Windows XP Pro Service Pack, or Windows XP Service Pack 2 fixed so much with the wireless management. I think 2000 is just going to be not a fun experience for you.
Okay, here's another question. When you connect to these networks, are you using the application that D-Link sent you, or are you using the built-in wireless management tools that come with Windows?
No, it's the D-Link. It's a little thing on the taskbar.
Yeah. Have you downloaded the? Yeah, sorry, Drew. You want to go ahead?
No.
Does this not work at the airport? Can you do it from home?
Yeah, it recognizes my home right away. But I was in Las Vegas 2 weeks ago, and the hotel had free wireless, and everybody was just hooked right up, and it couldn't find it.
You know what? It might be setting the firewall. The hotel, the airports, they have routers. There's some settings. I've run into this before. I had to fix my router, open something up so that I could connect remotely. And they may have that shut down. They might.
Oh, it's on their end.
You got to do two things. Make sure you have the very latest version of the D-Link software.
Okay.
On their website. And then the other thing
is... But it's out of his hands. He's dealing with the router at wherever he's trying to connect.
Yeah, but if everybody else is working at that environment, he's the only one that's having trouble connecting. It's probably his hardware, right?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think
I'm just telling you the problems
2000.
I had.
I think running 2000 is just going to be hard with wireless because Service Pack 2 did so much.
He's doing it from home, Lyle, and he can't do it from these other places.
Yeah. Once in a while it works. I was in Hawaii. I went down to the lobby. They said they had wireless, and it hooked right up right away. Yeah. I can see the network, the little D-Link. It shows me.
I think it's the way that the router is configured at the place that you're connecting from. That's what I think.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Which sorry, we're not much
not
help
good
there.
Help for you. Sorry
I have to
about
buy
that.
A new computer. Thank you.
I don't think it's your computer.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. The Geeks this morning, Miles Elam, Drew Meyer, and Sean Cleveland. Answering the phones was a combination of Maggie and Daria. I'm not sure who really did it, but thank you so much for stepping in. Rick was gone today. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. It sounds to me, Drew, that Mike's interested in being on. We have an opening next week for Mike to be on, so should we do a solar show next week?
Mike, send us an email or give us a call if you're available.
We'd love to do a discussion about solar energy.
And for our listeners, tune in next week for a show on solar, more than likely.
see, we should do it like as an official promo if we can write it in our heads right now.
Yeah.
Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Arturo, on the web at KOSP.org. Coming up next is Castle Cottage. I'm Lyle Troxell for KOSP and GeekSpeak. Thank you so much for supporting us this pledge drive. We made our numbers, and I really appreciate your contributions.